Alive and Kicking with Claire McKenna on News Talk.
Yes, you can email the show aliveandkicking@newstalk.com or you will find me on Instagram. I'm at Claire McKenna Presents. Coming up this morning, I'll be joined by family estrangement expert Carl Melvin on what led him to write his book to try and help people navigate this difficult but common life experience. I'll also be joined by Dr. Mark Rowe on the importance of embracing awe and self-care, and psychotherapist Cara Byrne on her top bugbear with wellness events. So what kind of a health and wellness week did I have? I've had a good week. As I said, work slowed down, so I've been catching my breath. We may have good news on a new home, which is great. I don't think I'll fully relax until I sign a contract and put a key in the door, but it's certainly looking like it is moving that way. I will keep you posted. And I often talk about how sometimes in life we can feel tired and we need to unwind more, relax more and rest more. But then there are also times in life where we feel drained and tired because there isn't enough joy and fun in our lives. That old saying we have of being all work and no play, it's actually true. You can be toiling away, falling into bed at night, doing everything you're supposed to do, eating the vegetables and getting the early nights. But if there's no joy, it will actually start to eat away at your motivation and eventually at our energy levels. Now, you can start small. You can start noticing small things to be grateful for. We'll be getting more into that with Dr. Mark Rowe in a while. The birds singing, a hot cup of coffee, a seat on the bus, feeling joy in those moments. It can really start to take your energy levels up a notch. Or you can meet a friend for a coffee or go to see a movie in the cinema, whatever it is that you like to do. Or you can go full throttle like I did and go to a festival where there is an abundance of joy to be had. Sequins, glitter, mud, music, and people letting loose and having fun. And after the roller coaster of the festival that almost wasn't to be, it was confirmed that Beyond the Pale was going ahead, and it was a great weekend. So fair dues to all of the team for getting it over the line and giving us all a great fun weekend. And Wicklow, I'd have to say, was also playing a blinder. Always one of my favourite places to go. So gorgeous. And the food we ate was amazing enough that it's actually worth a mention. We had dinner in the coach house in Roundwood. We had breakfast in the Wicklow Heather. And on our last morning, Roundwood Stores. And I'm already thinking, how can I make my way back to eat that food again? I want to fill you in on an event that is taking place. It is on Wednesday, June 25th in Smock Alley Theatre. It's called Gut Matters. It's a night of gut health discussions, nibbles, drinks and a goodie bag on arrival. Tickets are €25. They're available on Eventbrite and all proceeds are in aid of Crohn's and Colitis Ireland. You might remember I had Una O'Hagan and Amy Kelly, who is the COO of Crohn's and Colitis Ireland, and they'll both be there. They were on the show recently and they'll both be there on the night, as well as other panel discussions with experts. So if you want to learn more about gut health, or indeed you have any issues and would like to get more information, come along to a lovely setting and a lovely evening. You can email the show aliveandkicking@newstalk.com, and there's more information on that event on my Instagram. Now, speaking of Instagram, a reel caught my eye recently, posted by a friend of mine, Cara Byrne. She's a psychotherapist, also known as the Hike Psych, because she takes many of her clients for a walk and a talk. We actually ran an event together in Wicklow a while back with Shu Lin. Her post was about a danger of sorts with wellness events, and Cara joins me in studio now. Cara, you're very welcome.
Am I allowed to call you my pal?
You are, of course.
Great.
Honoured to be called such.
Tell me about posting the video, because I think putting yourself out there like that, we're told this is the way of the world, put your opinions out there. When you hit post and upload, how did it feel?
I am usually quite measured and cautious in what I put out, especially if it can be taken up as critical. So I was, to be honest, quite concerned about the reaction I would get. But I'm also a bit of a fly by the seat of my pants sort of person. So I did one take. I just started talking and I just press send. I just don't overthink it. And I thought it was a really important topic, and it's something that has bothered me for such a long time, and I see more and more of it. And that is, you know, people within the wellness space making promises that really they shouldn't be making, offering things that just aren't possible through the services that they provide. And that does put people in danger. And they might not realise that they're doing that. But I do think it's something that should be addressed, because there isn't really any oversight in wellness like there is in therapy or, you know, in the medical profession. So
when did this come to your attention?
I've seen it for years, to be honest. You know, there's been many things, but I had seen somebody else, another psych therapist, had done something similar. It was on a little reel that someone was basically advertising that they could cure their anxiety if they just did this one meditation, you know, and she posted about it and I saw it and I just thought, yeah, that really drives me crazy too. So I think I'll just say a few words and just explain, I guess, the difference between the kind of work that we have to put in as therapists to make sure that we don't injure or harm our clients. It's, you know, we don't take a Hippocratic oath like the doctors do, but we still have a duty of care. You know, do no harm should be the first thought that comes into your head before you offer any service to people who are often in a vulnerable state.
I did a bit of research, and actually there was a lot of comments underneath your post that led me to other areas and even websites advertising events and some of the things that were being promised. And it really shocked me, to be honest.
And you're in that space, you know.
Yeah, and that's why I was really happy to have you on, because I think it's a really important conversation to have. And I thought you were very measured in what you said, because you said, look, there are a lot of yoga practitioners, breathwork practitioners who are doing a really good job, and they are giving people a great space to calm their central nervous system, come back into their body, relax in the midst of busy lives. And all of that is amazing and needed. And in fact, you're trained in breath work yourself. So these are all very positive things. Yeah. It's the promises. It's the language. And
it is.
I've had an issue for a while with the word healing. I think it's a very loaded word. So healing, cure.
Yeah.
Your inner child.
Yeah.
And treatment. I even saw one promise that they would get more out of their psychotherapy sessions by coming to a wellness event. So I can we pick that. Apart some of that language?
Yeah. The purpose of wellness is prevention. It isn't treatment. It's prevention and maintenance of good mental health. But what is being offered is, And again, it's so important to mention, most providers are doing their very best and they're just offering, you know, a lovely relaxation space, a lovely hour to yourself, you know, like that, good for your nervous system. And all of these things are true. But there is a particular cohort who are offering, you know, cures for your trauma, cures for your anxiety. Trauma is not something that should be addressed in a group setting when you have no idea what trauma means to that person or the other people in that space. And the term safe space gets used a lot. And I've seen that too in places where I've gone to for breath work or for meditation. And they're like, this is a safe space. But what does that mean? Does that mean that if I get triggered by something deeply painful to me, I'm going to be protected and that everybody else in that room is going to be protected from being triggered by my reaction? I think we need to be very, very clear and careful about that. And I don't think active trauma should ever be dealt with, or unresolved trauma, in a group setting. I think it needs to be dealt with one-on-one in a very safe space, and absolutely use breathwork and meditation as supports when they fit, but not as the treatment for it.
It's so interesting, because not really being talked about enough. Yeah. And yes, there are some wellness practitioners who will ask for a waiver to be signed, but that's almost protecting them. And we're talking about protecting vulnerable people, and just this lack of knowledge. I don't think there's many nefarious people out there. These people are well intentioned. They're thinking, come, breathe, let go, heal your trauma, connect with your inner child with the best of intention. But we need to be careful about what training has gone into that. And that's something else that you brought up.
That's the thing. There's no oversight, whereas when you train as a therapist, you have got to go into every single dark space in your mind and deal with basically everything. And look, we're all works in progress, you know, it's ongoing. But as I was saying in the reel, like, we have to do weekly therapy for 4 years to make sure that nothing our client says is nothing of ours is interfering with the things that our clients bring into the room, that we're essentially as much as possible untriggerable. Because if you're not conscious of your own processes, you can be interfering with what's going on for the client. And if I get triggered, then I'm also not safe for everybody else, because whatever's going on for me might be influencing how I'm interacting with everybody else in that space. I still have to do, you know, every second week we do clinical supervision. When we're training, we do it weekly and group therapy. There's so much that goes into making sure that we are able to handle whatever comes up without losing ourselves in it.
Would you like to see regulation in this area? I mean, I'm lucky, and look, I only know my own experience, but with the academy that I trained in breathwork, it has become a community. There's a monthly meeting. Yeah. You know, you can contact with any at any time with any questions, queries, issues. Yeah. So it's not like you're just given the certificate and sent out into the world.
Yeah.
And I hope most places are like that. And I know certainly yoga teachers are a great yeah. community resource to each other. But do we need that sort of regulation in the same way you as a psychotherapist have that supervision, that there's an overseeing body for these wellness practices?
I think that would be great, you know, because the vast difference in the level of training is huge too. But there's people who do an online 2 hours, you know, over a weekend course and will take a group of people into the same space that you will. And, you know, there's no minimum criteria to call yourself a coach. You know, obviously in the field that I'm in, you have to do a master's degree, or you have to do, you know, if you're a psychologist, sometimes even a doctorate. It really does come down to how much investment the people themselves have put into learning that skill and building up their knowledge to be able to deal with all of these things. And there's zero oversight.
I'd love to get people's thoughts. You can email us aliveandkicking@newstalk.com. Be you someone who has gone to these wellness events, or a practitioner, because, you know, like I put my hand up this time. So I think, you know, am I qualified for this? And it would be good to have a roadmap in these situations. It's protecting everybody.
Absolutely.
And I think that's really important. If you want to find out more about Cara's work, you can go to The Hike Psych on Instagram. Cara Byrne, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you.
Alive and Kicking on News Talk.
Now, Dr. Mark Rowe is a best-selling author of 4 books and a lifestyle medicine pioneer. He spent years researching the intersection of science, spirituality and well-being. And Mark joins me in studio now. Mark, you're very welcome.
Delighted to be here, Claire.
And Mark, that's how you feel about physical health as well, isn't it? That rather than waiting for something to go wrong and go to the GP, that small little things that we do every day can make a massive difference.
And now, so prevention is better than a ton of cure. And, you know, I've been a GP for over 30 years. I'm really interested in people, what makes them tick, what keeps us well. And of course, there's a world of difference between feeling unwell or feeling sick and living at your best. So people sometimes say to me, well, what is well-being? And sometimes people feel it's this very woolly term, which is understandable because it's not an easy thing to define. We all know when we feel well ourselves, but really, you know, well-being incorporates, as you said, not just our mental health, but our physical health, our emotional health, the quality of our relationships, living with purpose, being able to spend time with people that lift you up, that support you, and to spend time in health-enhancing environments. So there's a lot in it. And it's really about that combination of being able to cultivate positive emotion, to experience a flow state, which is really to live with engagement and live with purpose, to have strong relationships, a deep sense of meaning, and also a sense of accomplishment. They talk about the accomplishing life. And those 5 elements, to a greater or lesser extent, are what we all need to experience well-being, underpinned, of course, by the greatest asset any of us can ever have, which is health, the golden egg. The crown on the well person's head that sometimes only the sick person can see, because we all take it for granted.
Yeah, that's the other saying that does the rounds all the time, and it's so true. Your health is your wealth. Without that, there's no money in the world can fix it. And it so much of it is within our control. And this has very much become your deeper meaning and purpose. Obviously, becoming a GP, you wanted to help people, but changing the conversation. I mean, I've been down to visit you in Waterford and you were telling me about your, is it the green prescription you give people? And you tell them to go out in nature. And these are the type of things rather than just the prescription for the antibiotics, which have their place too.
I was talking to a good friend of mine this morning on the phone, and she was talking about how, you know, when she's a doctor, and, you know, when you're a doctor, you're always a doctor because it's part of who you are. And it's so true. It's the essence of your being, really, to look after other people. So the doctoring of being a doctor is one thing. It's the technical side. But really, the essence is really all about purpose. And for me, my purpose is all about service and serving others in ways that can support them to improve their health. And I suppose since the great financial crash, I've become really interested in how we can support people in other ways besides pills. Because while pills can be life-saving and medicine can be marvellous and fantastic and absolutely, you'll never meditate away pneumonia, as I say. But when people are really struggling and bereft of hope, in fear of losing their homes and they lost jobs and so on back in 2010, people needed a new sense of hope and people needed new skills and strategies to support them to become well again. And that's really when I began to look at lifestyle medicine and the many ideas and tools in positive health. And it turns out that really small, simple things can make such a big difference. Getting outdoors. So many people nowadays suffer from what I would call indooritis. Just lack of fresh air, lack of blue light, as you know. And getting out in nature can just be so incredibly good for us in so many ways.
And I think another woolly term is self-care. It's something people hear, but they're not 100% sure what it means. I know International Self-Care Day is coming in July. What does it mean to you?
It means so many different things. You know, I was just in a taxi coming in here and the taxi driver just asked me, just as we got up to the studio here, he noticed I was carrying my book and he said, "Are you going into Newstalk?" So I told him I was, and he said, "Well, you know, what is it all about?" And what I said to him was being kind to yourself. I think if you're kind to yourself in a way that also enables you to be kind to others, so it's not a selfish, self-centered, narcissistic form of self-care, it's an expansive, inclusive, the first two letters in the word well-being are W and E, we, us together. It's not about me, it's not me-itis. It's valuing. I think, you know, people talk about all this long list of things I must do. But really, it's about valuing. Because if you value yourself, you will take that little bit better care of yourself. And often it's about stopping things as opposed to starting things. So the opposite of self-care is probably self-sabotage. And many people move into self-sabotage when they're experiencing stress, chronic stress, toxic stress. And of course, there's lots of reasons why people can feel stressed and do in modern life for all sorts of genuine reasons. So to be able to recharge from the stress is the key. But of course, the brain consumes so much sugar that when your brain is deprived of energy, you move back into self-sabotage mode where you'll now crave comfort, you'll crave relief from the stress, you'll crave sugar. You might crave alcohol, you might crave whatever, gambling, whatever it might be. The inner critic can run riot in that situation. So self-care is not about being perfect, because no one and nothing ever is. It's understanding that sometimes just staying in contention is more than good enough, dealing with what might be coming at you in life. But it's also having the courage, and I use the word courage deliberately, having the courage to start. As I say, never stop starting. Having the courage to start in very, very small ways to better value your health.
And it's so interesting. I always talk about self-worth being at the nub of it because people get quite stuck in the good and bad way of thinking. So it's being good to live a really strict way and that there's not going to be any more takeaways, there's not going to be any more fast food, there's not going to be any more sugar. And that's being good, but that's hard. Whereas being bad is fun. And they kind of lose that. I like the way you're separating it into self-sabotage or self-care. Of course, there's going to be times where you're going to have a pizza delivered to the house or you're going to have a dessert or pick up a bar of chocolate in a shop. But choosing more often than not to eat nutritious food is ultimately going to make you feel better. It is an act of self-love. It's not self-flagellation. And I just think that's always a really important idea for people to get their head around, that self-care can look differently, that constantly reaching for those things to prop you up ultimately are undoing you underneath it all. You're thinking you're not worth feeling as good as you can for as long as you can.
Well, it all starts on the inside with feeling content and happy and at peace in yourself. And I think people overly focus on the binary notion of I'm either eating well, I'm on my A game, or I'm, you know, eating a lot of junk food or whatever it is. Whereas really food is only one part of the puzzle of well-being. And, you know, the leading indicator of our well-being long-term is the quality of our relationships. Brilliant study, the Harvard study of adult development going on since the 1930s. It's into its third generation now. You know, have you got somebody you could call at 5 o'clock in the morning if you were in trouble, if you're really worried? Have you got a really close confidant in your life? Might be a life partner or might be a really good friend, family member. But having somebody can make a huge difference. The people that had the best relationships at age 50 in this research turned out to be the healthiest at age 80. This is massive. And of course, the paradox, Claire, as you know, of connection and good relationships is the absence of these relationships. This taxi driver was telling me that he used to work in insurance and he used to call to these elderly people living in flats in central Dublin. This is about 20 years ago. And he said they were so lonely and he knew that he was their only contact, maybe for days on end. And he had that awareness. He used to spend some time with them. He was a kind guy. But, you know, loneliness really can cause so many problems in terms of your physical health, increases your risk of memory loss, heart disease, falls, depression. It lights up the same brain areas as physical pain. Imagine that on fMRI scans. So there really is a sense of pain, emotional pain from loneliness.
Well, that's the GP you want to have, isn't it? Or not have. You're talking yourself out of a job, which is a lovely thing. You can either go to his Waterford clinic, see the butterflies, or you can get his latest book. It's called Things Your Future Self Will Thank You For. Dr. Mark Rowe, thank you very much for coming on.
It's a pleasure. Thank you, Claire.
Alive and kicking on News Talk.
Now, Carl Melvin is a psychotherapist and family estrangement expert. As well as running a busy practice, he delivers training globally to both estranged adults and professionals seeking to support this complex family issue. He's poured his expertise and his experience into his book, Navigating Family Estrangement, and Carl Melvin joins me in studio now. Carl, you're very welcome.
Thank you so much, Claire. Lovely to meet you.
So what led to your specific interest in this area?
Yeah, there's an interesting theme. Anyone who specializes in this area, they tend to have some subjective experience. So I do as well. Estrangement kind of is part of my own life. It's something I've had to live with for quite a long time. I think it was actually my entry into psychotherapy full stop, because I became estranged from certain people. I don't go into much detail publicly about it, but it would have been around 2007. And I just figured I'll just deal with this on my own. And it took about a year and a half to realise I was failing miserably at dealing with it on my own. I went to a therapist, had a great experience, I decided to re-educate. And then estrangement followed me. I didn't kind of consciously decide to specialise in this, but literally from the very first client they ever worked with, and they were struggling with their family in very complex ways. And then from that point forward, this constant pattern of people coming in who were struggling in different ways with their families to the point where they became estranged. And I had all of this experience, which meant I had an understanding of what they might be going through and the challenges that they're facing. But I also had my own approach to how to manage those challenges because I faced them myself. And, you know, that just led to more and more clinical experience, trying to understand why, you know, what families look like, how families fall apart in different ways that they do. And the more I do it, the more I realise how little I know, how complicated families are across different cultures, different countries, different religious beliefs. And it's just trying to pull it together into an approach where professionals, whether it's psychologists, therapists, social workers, mediators, can try and develop some insight into the complexity of family life in contemporary society, how they fall apart, and what we can do to support people through that.
It's such an earth-shattering word, isn't it? Estrangement, because we don't use it in any other context. You know, break down, break up. We use them in different definitions, and it's something we get more used to. Estrangement is something you only really use in this context. Yeah. What is the definition of family estrangement?
Well, see, let me ask you, what do you think it is?
Well, you're not speaking to a family member anymore.
Yeah. So you're not wrong, but you're not fully right either. And you're right, if you asked the average person, and I would have thought the same, especially early in my clinical practice, the people that were coming in had reached a point where there was no contact at all. But estrangement is fundamentally about family members creating distance from each other, but they're very consciously creating distance, okay? So estrangement is not the same as losing touch. It's not the same as the normal kind of fallouts that happen. Like, families have rows, they disagree, they might go a period of days, weeks, and then they meet up and everything is fine. Estrangement is something much more long term, sometimes very permanent. But the distance that exists in families, it sits on a continuum. So we'll have people who we would say are less estranged, and that might mean an emotional estrangement. So there's examples where families are actually talking to each other on a regular basis for a whole range of reasons. For example, maybe there's a health crisis in the family and all of a sudden people have to speak to each other, they have to interact. Maybe Christmas, holiday periods, people have to interact. Maybe habit, tradition, guilt, shame. These all influence why families actually stay together, even if they'd rather not do that. Then the other end of the continuum are people who, are more estranged. And that's similar to a physical estrangement. And in those cases, people go to extreme lengths to not have no contact whatsoever with their family. And I've had clients who are Irish, but they live in Australia and the US and all over the world. And publicly, they'll say to people, I moved away to improve the quality of their life and get, you know, maybe earn a better income. Privately, they're telling me, Carol, I was getting away from the chaos of my family because it was so unmanageable. And they felt like there's no other choice. The only way for them to feel safe and get some sense of themselves was to pull back completely. And I've even heard extreme examples of people changing their names, of selling the house in a very short space of time and not telling any family members at all. And it's relative to how unsafe they felt in that dynamic and how communication had completely broken down to the point where, like, this is how far back I need to be from these people.
Okay, so there may be contact in certain circumstances, but a boundary has gone up.
Yeah, I mean, the difference between low contact versus no contact, and they're really common terms, you see. Again, low contact is more the less estranged. We do talk, maybe not as frequently as we did in the past, but there's still some interactions there. Even I see families, they communicate on a very superficial level. Like, they keep it very basic and very civil, but underpinning that is a great deal of anger, resentment, and it does play out at some point, often when there's drink or often when it's Christmas or other family events where people are really forced to be around each other. Then no contact is the obvious. They do go, again, no physical contact, no phone contact, no nothing.
How prevalent is it? You go into that a little bit in the book, and I found that interesting.
Yeah, again, the research varies. So the study that I would have cited the most came from the UK, and that was 2015. And they came in at 1 in 5 adults are estranged from their family members, which is a high enough population. But everybody was waiting for a US study around 2020 because they were hopeful that it might give us a better indication. And that researcher came in at 1 in 4 adults, which is about, it was actually close to the 27%. It was a US study, and there's going to be cultural differences between here and the US, particularly when you look at divorce is often cited as the most common reason, and divorce rates are much higher in the US than they are over here. But if you cling to that figure, 1 in 4, that's something like 67 million people in the US alone are affected by this. I've always argued estrangement has always been here. It's not necessarily on the rise, and there's the discussions around are more people becoming estranged. We don't have data to support that. We do know that there's more people talking about it publicly, which may suggest it's on the rise, but we don't know. But I think in Ireland, we've just culture of pushing things under the carpet. You know, we're very good at it. And I think what was happening, that there was a lot of issues that were under the current, not spoken about, not addressed properly. People were still interacting and still having some kind of a relationship, but not close, not comfortable, not sharing aspects of themselves. But with social media and more people sharing the situation, it's almost normalizing people pulling back and actually going full no contact and creating as much physical distance as they can get.
I think there's a lot of stereotypes we have around estrangement, and you really break a lot of them down and gave me a real understanding. I think we often think money is at the root of a lot of it, you know, that where there's a will, there's a war kind of thing. And that can happen. That can really break families apart, particularly when they're in the throes of grief or recalibrating when they've lost a family member. But you go through the different reasons, and they're complex and many, but sometimes there can be tragic circumstances, addiction or something along those lines. And there can also be more valid reasons. So we should try and break through these stereotypes, because that sort of adds to guilt and shame, doesn't it, around it?
There's an awful stigma surrounding this. And if you even look at the research around estrangement and the stereotypes that exist around it, I mean, it's interesting. Sons and daughters who are estranged from their parents, there's some positive stereotypes. Sometimes they're actually viewed as being independent and strong and standing up for themselves. But there's negatives there as well around being selfish and being unrealistic in their expectations. But parents, on the other end of this, is parents, mothers and fathers who are estranged from their sons and daughters. And the stereotypes are universally negative, and particularly for mothers, which is an awful tragedy, because I would work with a lot of mothers who are estranged from their sons and daughters, and they're lovely people and they're not abusive. And they, in many cases, they don't understand how this happened. Often they feel like there's other alienating factors, like a partner or somebody else in their life who's influencing this person, that their son or daughter, to the point where they're just pulling back. But you're right, the reasons are very complicated, and it's rarely isolated to one thing. Now, in the research, again, they have to kind of identify and categorise certain things. So from the perspective of sons and daughters, they'll often say that the main reason is emotional abuse. And then underneath that, pressures, favouritism, unrealistic expectations. But if you look at the parents' perspective, they'll always accredit it to something external, not something that they did, but something outside of themselves. So again, parents will say divorce is the number one reason why they became estranged. But we know that within that title, within that process of becoming divorced, it's much more complicated. There's conflicts, there's breakdown of communication, there's pressures, there's expectations around loyalties. They all contribute to the estrangement. So it's not just divorce. It's the nature of the divorce. It's the quality of the co-parenting relationship after it. But yeah, and so part of these conversations are bringing more nuance into it, because it is complicated. But some people do cling to certain things. You know, a really common one, which is very tragic, is the abuse that happens in families. And I have to talk about that. But some people only talk about that, or some people don't want to talk about it because it's either too difficult, or they feel like it's invalidating their own experiences. For example, if it's a parent, you know, they don't want to hear about abuse because they feel like they weren't abusive and it wasn't their fault. And maybe that's true. But again, it's been able to hold the difficult conversation and say we're not blaming or judging anybody, but we have to have nuance if we're actually going to try to heal this situation. Not necessarily bring families back together, because that isn't always appropriate, but help people move forward with their lives and maybe grieve some of this, just create a sense of themselves away from the family unit, which is a very hard thing to do. You know, if you identify as a mother and a father, which many of us do, and then that son and daughter, or all of them, are not talking to you anymore, well, who am I now? You know, and not only that, I don't know who I am because my identity has changed, but I also don't get to grieve this publicly. There's no funeral for people who are estranged. So the rituals and the traditions that we have that are so important to our society are not available to us because of the stigma, and because society generally can't quite understand how is this a form of grief. They live 10 minutes down the road. You can ring them right now and have a chat with them. But then something has changed, something has lost between them, and it may not be recovered. And being able to even acknowledge that and give people some support for that. And it's hard. And even, you know, I would have clients come to me who previously gone to therapists. And look, therapy is an incredibly hard job, and I admire anyone that does it, but they don't always get it right. And there's a tendency sometimes to bring in our own families into the conversation, which isn't always appropriate. And I call it the subjective blur in the book, because like we're here talking about a broader concept of family, but as a part of you that's a little bit thinking about your own family, and same for me and same for every human being that's watching this, but it's bigger than our own families. And we're going to talk to another person about their family. We have to be able to draw the line between my experiences, my attachments, and what I've been through versus everybody else. But it requires a level of reflection that's not people are even, they've not motivated, they've no interest in thinking in those terms. So then they project, which is what human people do, when they'll project their own values, their own beliefs, their own views, their own experiences. And what I find as well, for example, if I was to share a situation where a parent was a person that was experienced abuse from a parent, talking to somebody else whose parent was lovely, it could trigger a really defensive response inside of them. They become really uncomfortable with this conversation or with this idea that there is a parent out there who was mean or being disrespectful or maybe even abusive. And those defensive reactions get in the way as well. And it's just trying to create platforms where we can talk about this and realize we're not talking about you, we're talking about somebody else. And that might open the door to more conversation and more nuance.
Yeah, and even different people's perspectives. Like, it really blew my mind when I read about even siblings in the one family, they can have very different experiences of the same parents in the same household, yeah, because the parents were at different stages of their life when they had each one of them, even with just a year or two between them. And you do also talk in the book, I had to need to kind of put it down for a minute and let it land for a minute, about how this is really important because it does bleed out into society. So we do view the family as our foundation. So when that splits for whatever reason, that can peter out into society and go in the reverse. Mm-hmm. And a lot of what you were talking about there with therapy and boundaries and all that, that can be a healthy thing to do. But can it be unhealthy for us to step away for our family, create that boundary for our own protection, but not get support with that?
Yeah. It's complicated. So there's different aspects to this. First of all, is estrangement a good thing? Okay. And there's people who will say that they've had positive effects from pulling back from family, more freedom, more independence. But is it good for the broader society? I don't know. Okay. And we don't really know because we don't have long-term studies around. We just have an insight into how it's affected the individuals who are affected. But across the whole family, it's a tough one to know. And you're right, it bleeds into so many different areas. I mean, I consider this a public health crisis, okay, because many people who come in, they were depressed, they were anxious, addiction problems, financial problems, all manner of health problems. I'm not saying family is the root cause of all of this because that's too reductive, but family is at the heart of a lot of it. And I know even with many of my own clients, they'll talk about they became estranged from family, it consumed them, they spent so much time ruminating, but then they got into work. Okay, and they're expected to perform at work. I remember one particular person, she had quite a senior job in her role in her job, and she started to make mistakes because she was distracted all the time because she was thinking about this. And that really bothered her, that all of a sudden this really devastating estrangement that happened over here is now contaminating another really important part of her life. But yeah, having the right support in place is important. But again, government doesn't really quite recognise this. You know, it's not something that's on their agenda. I'm doing some work at the moment with the USI, the Students' Union, because they're not even familiar with the issues around SUSI grants in Ireland, where if you're estranged from your parents, you have to prove your estrangement. The way you prove it is you contact the Gardaí or you contact TUSLA, a social worker. But can you imagine someone 17, 18, 19, 20, still very young, estranged from parents, and they're still suffering the psychological impact. The last thing they're going to do is report it to a guard or report it even to TUSLA because they're terrified of all of these consequences. And we've just started a campaign, hopefully we'll launch it later in the year. We're just trying to raise awareness around what estrangement is and how it affects students, because they're now deprived of really important economic support that they really need because they don't have the economic support from their family now.
Yeah, I mean, it is so complex. Mm-hmm. What changes would you like to see come in? You talk at length in the book about reducing this shame and stigma, because that can often create a roadblock to people seeking support. And then you also hope that this book makes it into the hands of professionals so that they have a roadmap of how to help people through family estrangement. I mean, there's never a magic wand, is it, to make sure all families get on well forever and ever? That would be lovely. But what is the things that you want to see change?
Yeah, I mean, you're right. It's a big ask to expect all families get on all of the time, and families have problems, but this is something much more insidious and much more long term, and it requires very specialised supports. It's hard to know what I'm asking because it's hard to know where we even begin. I mean, look, the likes of coming on and talking to you, like, this is part of what I'm asking for, just public discourse and a discourse that doesn't reduce people's experiences and isn't quick to form opinions. Even if you go onto social media now, which I make a point of doing, looking at the comment sections just to see the quality of the conversations and reactions. And in fairness, there is some improvement around people respecting that there's, like, for example, if it's an article that I may have written or somebody else has written around a case study, but there's only three or four paragraphs, you couldn't know enough to form an opinion based on that. And I'm seeing people saying, look, there's not enough information, but I say it's really tough. Like, something like that is an appropriate response. That's great. There's a degree of understanding, a degree of compassion. It's the other end of it where people can't wait to judge and form opinions based on very simplistic roles. For example, if someone is estranged from a parent, that's your mother, that's your father, that's disgraceful. You shouldn't call yourself, or you can't call yourself a son or a daughter anymore. So quick to judge, you know, and I think it would be ideal to have some kind of educational platform for people with the broader society and professionals specifically can actually go and learn something about this and be able to understand that it extends way past their own experiences, but invite them to park their own experiences and understand that this happens to so many people. It might even happen to them. I mean, my core values around this is don't take your family for granted, because I have seen families who were fine, who were functioning absolutely okay. And then one tragic loss, as you mentioned at the start, and all of a sudden everyone grieves differently. Not everyone can cope. The expectations after that loss are quite different as well. For example, one person may decide, I'm going to manage the funeral. I'm going to look after the headstone, the church and all the rest. And that could rub people up the wrong way. I'm working with someone at the moment who doesn't get on with his family. And one of his parents passed away, but the other family went ahead and picked the headstone, put the message on the headstone. He wasn't involved whatsoever in that decision. He's absolutely devastated by this because, again, he was deprived of an important part of the grieving process. So I think awareness campaigns is the start. Okay, just again, letting people know that this is something that's very real. It affects a great number of people, more than many realise. And again, that's part of the closed door nature of these issues. They do happen behind closed doors. No one sees what's happening. Everyone thinks that their family is the worst family in the world. It's only when you actually come together and have these type of conversations you realise it is so prevalent and that there is no perfect family. There's just a scale of some are more dysfunctional than others to the point where they literally cannot function. But yeah, education, I think it starts with education.
And I'm really conscious that there could be somebody listening who is going through this right now and is carrying that. So for someone listening estranged from their family member, what would your advice be to them?
Yeah, I mean, maybe it's a cliche, but they're certainly not on their own and understand that there's many people who are going through this. There's tons of resources online. Some people go towards the Facebook groups. There are Facebook support groups. The only thing I'll say is you kind of have to go in and watch them first and see how they're moderated, because some have different rules. I've seen Facebook groups where people were sharing pictures of their estranged family members or sharing messages of estranged family members. And I was appalled when I saw this because it's such a privacy or conflict of privacy and really stepping over boundaries. So, you know, reaching out for support if they're not ready to necessarily talk to their friends about it. But I would hope at some point they will actually start to talk to friends. Most people are struggling with their family. They do carry a great deal of shame, which negates the ability to feel comfortable sharing this really vulnerable and very painful thing to anyone that they're close to. And but more often than not, it's fine. The family or the friends will understand. They'll offer some kind of support. It's just taking that risk at the start to reveal this part of their life that they carry so much shame over. So I would encourage them, when they're ready, at least entertain the notion of talking to somebody. After that, and after they've shared and they realise nothing bad's going to happen, they're not going to become estranged from their friends, then it's even more layers of becoming more comfortable with asking for specific help, actually asking their partner and their friend, this is how specifically I need you, how to help me. Because everyone's needs are different based on the estrangement nature or the type of estrangement. So if someone interacts with their family regularly enough, they will need a different type of support from someone who's on the other end who never sees their family. I argue, and not that I prioritise clients, but when someone reaches out to me and I know they sometimes live under the same roof, sometimes they have an event coming up and they're dreading it, or christening, whatever it is, I kind of put more time into those people because I know they need that support. But it's actually finding out what exactly they need from me. But they, you know, what happens so much as well is that, I mean, most of my clients are women. Don't ask me why. Male participation is quite weak in the research and even shown up for therapy. But their partners, they're nice people, but they just don't get it. And being able to confront a partner and say, look, I actually really need your help. I need you to understand what I'm going through. And this is specifically what I need from you. Even that, it's good for their self-esteem. It's part of their own growth. And we have to take risks to grow. It's the only way.
Well, the book is excellent. It goes into huge detail. You've even mocked up case studies in the back of the different modalities and the roadmaps and how that helped in different situations. There's also a coping mechanism toolbox for people. as well as just looking at the topic from any angle and every angle. And I think, as you said, for people to realise that it is not necessarily something that they did wrong. It is not shame for them to carry, and that it is happening more often than, unfortunately, we speak about. But hopefully this conversation and this book is the start of many. The book is called Navigating Family Estrangement, Helping Adults Understand and Manage the Challenges of Family Estrangement. Carl Melvin, you can find out more at carlmelvin.com. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you so much, Claire.
Right, that's it for Alive and Kicking for this week. My thanks to my producer, Marais O'Sullivan, to all of my guests, to Rory Galvin, who was on podcasts, and to Hugo Da Silva Scott, who was on sound. And thanks to you for listening. I will see you next week.
Alive and Kicking with Claire McKenna. Sunday morning at 8 on News Talk.